are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, August 7th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Sam Pizzagatti on the case for a maximum wage. Also on the program today, Paul Manafort cooked. But this trial is just the hors d'oeuvre, folks. Meanwhile, Trump attacks citizenship for legal immigrants. And it's primary day, special election day. It's a referendum on right to work day in Missouri, anyways. All that on the ballot. And Trump slams California for having record-breaking wildfires. The DOJ is questioning the AT&T Time Warner merger. Rudy Giuliani is sort of kind of happy, hoping Mueller forgets about obstruction. And also, Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross is a thief. Lastly, New York City to make prison phone call profiteering a thing of the past. And I should say L.A. votes to remove Trump's star from the Hollywood Walk of Fame in the first time I have ever given a crap about the Hollywood Walk of Fame. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. The Hollywood Walk of Fame, the star. You know, they have stars on Hollywood. It's also, if you walk down Hollywood Boulevard right there, it does not feel like you're walking down a place where people, like famous people, walk. It doesn't feel like that at all. But apparently, the star keeps getting vandalized. And do they leave the hammer there each time? Like
the pickaxe?
The pickaxe.
They should just say they're prospecting.
Yeah.
It's California.
People accidentally put a pickaxe in the in Trump's star, and they keep fixing it, and then
it does look like the scene of a crime.
It does. It's sort of like they have like a chalk. They should be chalk outlining the pickaxe, and
it is a crime.
Sadly.
It has a little wall around it now.
Yeah, they that's right. They built a little wall on it. And this is great. I didn't know this. A guy in October 2016. Was dressed as a construction worker, brought like construction horses around it, and then began to chop it up. And then different people spray paint stuff on there. They put stickers on there.
I like the guy in the construction outfit because it just shows how much you can get away with if you put one of those vests on.
Well, yeah, but he also put all those cones around it, and he just came over there and started chopping it up. That's pretty awesome. L.A. has voted because of all of the vandalism that having a star with Donald Trump's name on your sidewalk promotes, that they had to get rid of it. So I would say for any other grown-up human being in the world, they would not care. But I would say that for Donald Trump, this has got to hurt.
Oh, yeah.
I hope what they do is they replace it with Rosie O'Donnell's star.
LeBron James, does he have a star yet? Probably
no,
does.
He should have one, though. Yeah. I don't know if they do it for athletes. I have no idea. Thus ends my excitement about the Hollywood stars. Now I can go back to never paying attention to that again. This was an interesting exchange, however. Last week, Global Affairs Canada This apparently is an agency. So what is an agent? A Canadian agency tweeted that it was gravely concerned about a new wave of arrests in Saudi Arabia targeting women's rights activists and urged their immediate release. I don't know if it's Global Affairs. It must be a Canadian government agency. And Saudi Arabia expelled Canada's ambassador and froze all new trade and investment with Canada in response to the criticism. Very sensitive. And so Saudi Arabia's state media on Monday tweeted the following graphic. And, well, this is what they had to say. As the Arabic saying goes, he who interferes with what doesn't concern him finds what doesn't please him. Hashtag Saudi Arabia. Hashtag Canada.
Ooh, I have to steal that.
And they made a meme of an Air Canada jet flying low over, Toronto? Yep. Flying low over, I guess that must have been the Great Lakes or something. One of the Great Lakes. I presume Toronto is on. And
that's the CN Tower.
And the plane appears to be flying essentially into this, it almost looks like the Space Needle in Seattle, but like a tower in Toronto. I guess the idea was like, hey, remember when we supposedly didn't commit 9/11? Well, it'd be a shame if that happened again to you. And here's a depiction of that. Sticking one's nose where it doesn't belong.
I think we can all see the humor in this.
Yes, that's pretty funny stuff from Saudi Arabia.
Let's go there.
Wait.
They have since deleted the tweet.
Was this like an official Saudi Arabia Twitter account?
It is the Saudi Arabia state media.
Ah, jeez.
Infographic _ Kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
That's insane.
Now, to be fair, they did. They deleted the tweet and then later re-upload one without the airliner pictured.
Yeah, they say, earlier we posted an image which was inappropriate, which is why we deleted the post immediately. The aircraft was intended to symbolize the return of the ambassador. We realized that this was not clear and any other meaning was unintentional. We apologize to anyone who was offended.
I don't know if I believe that. I find that a little hard to believe. But, Saudi Arabia must be feeling pretty good, feeling their oats these days. Everybody's getting on the Trump train.
I wonder where Thomas Friedman at.
Exactly. Folks, a reminder, BetterHelp is a sponsor of this program. They provide affordable, private, online counseling. You get unlimited access to a licensed, trained, fully accredited therapist that's perfect for you. You can do it on your phone. You can do it on your computer. You can do it through text, voice, or video chat. They're LGBT friendly. It's great for couples counseling, anything else you're going through in life right now. All you need to do is go to betterhelp.com/majority. You fill out a questionnaire. They match you with a counselor who's perfect for you. You start counseling today. If you decide you're not vibing with the therapist you're matched with, you can switch whenever you want. It's less expensive than in-person counseling. You're still getting the same great help from licensed professionals. And if you have trouble affording it, BetterHelp has financial aid available. And the thing that's pretty great about this, you are always connected to your counselor. You have unlimited access. It means that you can talk to them every day if you want. You can connect from them with them from anywhere you're at, home, at work, dorm room. So if you're not wasting time traveling to someone's office, sitting around in a waiting room, you have access to them. A lot of people are not comfortable talking to a therapist in person, or they simply don't have the time. They can't afford it. BetterHelp solves all these problems. You can sign up right now and save on quality professional therapy. by going to BetterHelp.com/majority. That's BetterHelp.com/majority. Let's play this Charlie Kirk. Apparently, Charlie Kirk, this is the guy from, what is it called?
Turning Points USA.
Turning Points USA. That's right. This is the organization that has been funneling money into campus races. In college, when people run for student government president or class president, this is an organization that is literally funding their campaigns for Republicans. Deviants. They're deviants, these people. And
the MAGA youth, I like to call them.
The MAGA youth. And apparently, Charlie Kirk was someone poured water on him or something? Is that what happened?
I would say threw fired water at him.
I don't know what that means. Fire water.
Fired water.
Okay. Are we going to see an image of that?
Or
right
dumped
now?
Water on his head, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Here he is, Charlie Kirk, under siege.
I would probably, if I was there, I would have stayed out because I'm a lunatic. But I would have advised you guys to go inside.
Well, so.
But you felt it was important not to.
Well, they drove us out of the restaurant. And Candace and I said, you know what? Let's just stand here for a couple minutes and show them that we're not going to back down. We're very peacefully. We're not going to retaliate if things get thrown at us. Little did we know we actually have stuff thrown at us. But look, we don't want to play the victim card here. That's what the left does all the time.
Instead of victim card.
So in other words, we went to a restaurant. We stood outside. Someone poured water on me, and then I came on TV to talk about it. But I don't want to play the victim card.
Yeah, we wanted to stand out there and show them that we weren't afraid. But little did we know, things got thrown at us and water got dumped on my head.
Right. Who could have imagined that water got dumped on my head, and then I would go on national television to talk about the fact that someone dumped water on my head. But I don't want to play the victim card here. Continue.
Does all the time.
Instead, not the victim card, but this is...
Use this as a warning. This is what's called on by Maxine Waters.
Did Maxine... Maxine Waters. Huh?
Coincidence?
We can QAnon, too.
Charlie Kirk, apparently out to eat. He was out with Candace Owens, right? And, they were asked to leave the restaurant. Was that what it was?
They were protesting inside the restaurant, and they said, "We're going to go stand outside." But, I mean, look, this is people do this in politics. You stand in front of a hostile crowd so you can get some photo ops. Nixon did this in Central America, put his wife in danger, actually. But
well, it was his wife. And Charlie Kirk was in a lot of danger. I mean, there were people with all sorts of different drinks. If he gets soda poured on him, it's sticky. Right? Waters was, you just dodged the bullet. Wine would have stained.
This was a warning shot.
Total warning
It'll
shot.
It'll be wine next time.
And here is Candace Owens, who is, I'm just going to let her tell you what it's like being in a coffee shop and having people protest you and then walking outside and watching your coworker gets someone spill water on him. You see if you can guess where she's going with this.
Instead, what we want to do is focus on, as a warning sign to the American people, that if the Democrats take back Congress, you're going to be electing these radicals.
Well, those are the
to
people
be in
that want to impeach the president.
That's correct.
They want open borders, eliminate ICE, keep Obamacare. They want their crumbs back, and they want these investigations to stop.
That's exactly right. And they had a bullhorn, and they were very close to my face, screaming in my ear. It was reminiscent of the civil rights era. This is what you would expect at the civil rights era if a black woman was dining at a restaurant.
You know, you've been through a lot, though. This is not the first time. It seems that race comes up a lot because you happen to be conservative and you happen to be an African-American.
That's correct.
This is Deneen Borelli's book. Remember I mentioned it to you?
Mm-hmm.
You know, read the Google my name and the most horrific names come up.
That's correct. Because liberals believe that they own blacks still. They believe that there is something proprietary about being black in this country. And if you deviate from the way that they want you to think and the way that they want you to act, they grow violent.
So her experience was like the civil rights, like the of a black woman who is eating in a restaurant during the civil rights era. I have a feeling it's not. It was probably a little. There were people a little more aggressive. Not pouring a glass of water on the coworker, on the white coworker. I have a feeling it's not quite there. Yeah, here's some images. I mean, this is sort of like it, I guess. Water cannons, glass of water.
It's a difference in degree, not kind, I guess.
Right. White guy getting water slowly poured on him. Black youth getting shot at with water cannons when they went to go eat. Yeah, it's close.
It's a good thing they're not playing the victim, though.
It's a good thing they're not playing the victim card.
Also, I don't know that it's necessarily that it just happens to be because she's conservative that race comes up with her. I think it's because she says things like white liberals feel like they own blacks, which implies a certain thing about black Democratic voters that maybe people have trouble swallowing.
It's also she just happens to be comparing it to the civil rights movement. Just happens to be.
Well, MAGA chuds are the new oppressed class in this country.
There you go. All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Sam Pizzagatti on his new book, The Case for a Maximum Wage. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program an associate fellow at the Policy Study Institute and the co-editor of inequality.org, Sam Pizzagatti, the author of The Case for a Maximum Wage. Sam, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
All right, let's start with, and I think, you know, this audience, broadly speaking, probably understands the broad strokes of the problem when we talk about income inequality. But give us a sense of where we are in terms of income inequality and what are the hallmarks of it.
Well, essentially, over the past four decades, we've had an enormous shift of income in the United States. The share of income that goes to the bottom 90% of Americans has been more than cut in half. And meanwhile, the share of income that goes to the top 1% has nearly tripled, from 7% at its lowest ebb in the middle of the 20th century to 21-22%, depending on the study today. So that's an enormous change in who has income, who has wealth, and who has power in the United States.
Give us some figures when it comes to, and I don't have it in front of me, but you wrote about the income and wage income that folks in, I guess, in the first 90% of our country are capturing, and I know that we see this in the context of things like of Social Security taxes, what they capture, but give us a sense a little more sense of what's happening in terms of just wages and income.
Okay, so essentially, since the end of the 1960s, the beginning of the 1970s, real incomes for the bottom 90% have essentially totally stagnated. There's been no increase if you take inflation into account, despite fairly substantial increases in the productivity of the U.S. economy. So the gap between the bottom 90% since 1990 alone, the gap between the bottom 90% and the top 0.1%, that gap has more than doubled only since 1990. There's been a tremendous concentration of labor income at the top of our economic summit.
What are the factors that have driven this from your perspective?
Well, there are a number of factors, but they, in the middle of the 20th century, when we did become substantially more equal as an American society, there were two major institutional factors that drove that growing equality in the United States, and those two factors were closely related. One was the progressive income tax system. We had tax rates in the United States in the 20 years after World War II that hovered over 90% for the top income bracket. So that was one major factor, those progressive tax rates in those decades right after World War II. Second factor was a strong labor movement. The combination of those two kept incomes in the United States from at the top from escalating and rose incomes at the base of the American economy.
So we had and my understanding is that the top income bracket at that time was probably around, if I'm not mistaken from memory, somewhere around like $470,000 and probably equivalent to like a $3 million today. Would that be where it was?
That's right. So individual income over $200,000 and joint return income over $400,000 was subject to that 90%, 91% tax rate throughout the Eisenhower years in the 1950s.
And then of course the labor movement was sort of adding pressure on wages at the lower end of the scale and sort of pushing it all towards the middle, and that's what gave us at least in part the Great Compression. So as that fell apart, like what was the nature of the of that regime falling apart? I mean, we saw. I know at one point Kennedy lowers taxes to 75%, but as far as I can tell, the big jump was that change in capital gains taxes and how CEOs and folks in that corner of the offices were paid.
That's right. The first tax cut proposal, as you said, came from John F. Kennedy in 1963. He proposed a 65% top rate instead of the 91%. Congress went along with a 70% top tax rate, and then Ronald Reagan in 1980 dropped the rate first to 50% and then to 28%. Meanwhile, as those rates those tax rates for the top income bracket were shrinking, we saw CEO pay rising. So in the 1960s, typical CEOs of major corporations only made 30 times more than their workers. Today, they're averaging over 300 times more than their workers. Again, there's been a tremendous shift, and those CEO pay figures are closely related to the tax figures. If you have a 91% top rate, what's the sense of paying a CEO more? Because if we pay the CEO more, that more will simply, most of it will simply get taxed away. But as tax rates lower, then there becomes more and more incentive on the part of CEOs and corporations to raise those top pay rates.
And I mean, when we talk about raising, and I know this is a little bit outside of what you do, but when we talk about, like, you know, there was just a decision to pay the CEO, like, what is that process? Because it just sounds like, oh, well, we're going to pay them more because they're going to get more, right? Like, who's making that decision making? Because it really is, I mean, as far as I can tell, a bunch of people sitting around at the top of the company, board of directors, saying, like, if he gets more, and I do mean he, if he gets more, we're all going to get more. Right. I mean,
That's right. That's exactly right. And if you look at the makeup of corporate boards, many of the people serving on corporate boards are top executives at other corporations. So it's a huge game of you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. And that over time, of course, escalates CEO pay at the top.
All right. And that form of CEO pay, and what form does it take? I mean, it's not like this is not. We're paying you wages, and the first 110,000 is subject, 120,000 subject to Social Security tax. You're going to be paying FICA Medicare taxes for your entire wages when people get $15 million a year or something like that, right? It's paid, most of it's paid through capital gains.
It's paid through stock-based compensation. So you have the basic CEO paycheck, you know, a paycheck like regular working people receive, and that only makes up a minor proportion of the pay packages that CEOs receive. The vast majority of the pay that goes to top CEOs comes in the form of stock-based compensation. It can either be stock options, where CEOs get the option to buy stock at a low rate when that stock appreciates in value, and then can sell the stock and make a killing, or in what's called restricted stock, where CEOs will get a certain number of shares at a certain point. So at their second anniversary, third anniversary, or if they make some sort of statistical milestone, they'll get a chunk of shares of stock outright. And when you add up those stock rewards plus bonuses, they dwarf what CEOs get in actual paycheck income.
I ask you this only because I still remember getting your other 98%, I think, newsletters back in the day. But what is there data? Has anybody like graphed layoffs relative to when stocks vest in CEOs? Because I'd be really curious to see the relationship between major cost cutting and how many months there's a difference between when that takes place and a CEO gets a big vesting of stocks.
Well, at the Institute for Policy Studies, where in Washington, where I have my shingle, every Labor Day since 1993, we've released an annual report that looks at CEO compensation. And each of these reports usually has a particular theme. So we've looked, for instance, at layoffs and CEO pay. And what we find is that CEOs that lay off the most prodigiously tend to be the highest paid CEOs. We also find that CEOs that outsource fit that category as well. So all the negative aspects of CEO behavior that you can think of end up linking to higher CEO compensation.
Okay, so we have We have this extraordinary delta between what your average worker makes and what a CEO makes. How much of wealth inequality is a function of that delta? In other words, like, is
okay,
it,
that's
good.
Great question. Great question. If you look at the top 1/10 of 1%, the richest 1/10 of 1% of folks in the United States, a huge proportion of those happen to be top corporate executives and top banking executives. In fact, they make up 60% of the top 1/10 of 1%. So if we're talking about corporate and financial industry executive pay, we're talking about getting that under control, we're speaking to a real driver of income inequality in the United States.
What's the other 40%? I mean, I would imagine like there's some, I guess, inherited wealth there, and then
There's some inherited. You have, real estate tycoons like a certain Donald Trump. You have doctors. Some doctors have, built up empires. You have some attorneys. Interestingly, when people think of the super rich, they usually think of Oprah Winfrey and various LeBron James and other celebrities. But if you add up all the actors in Hollywood, all the sports stars, all of the recording artists, all these celebrities who were in the news, they only make up 3% of that top 1/10 of 1% in American society.
Wow. So this type of wealth is largely obscured to people. Right?
Yes.
Like, we think we see it when we see Oprah or LeBron or your favorite podcaster or something, but we really don't see this at all, right? I mean, there's a handful of top executives that people know their names, Bill Gates, Elon Musk, and Jeff Bezos. But outside of like a small number of people, we don't see who these people are.
That's right. It's an invisible, so to speak, corporate elite that we have in the United States that has captured for itself a hugely disproportionate share of our nation's income and wealth.
Okay, so you have outlined how this was kept under control under what some call the Great Compression, where we had the least amount of income inequality and probably on some level wealth inequality, too, that we've had in this country. The method in which that took place was redistribution. We had taxes that at the upper end, after a certain amount, became almost confiscatory, I guess, or arguably confiscatory. But that was after like the first 3 million or so that you would make as a couple.
Right.
Your idea to fix this is different.
Yes. So if we look back at the middle of the 20th century, which in terms of economic equality was a heroic era in U.S. history because of those redistributive taxes. The problem was those taxes could not be sustained over time, and they couldn't be sustained in Britain either, and in several other European countries. The basic problem is as rich people take those 90% plus tax rates as a personal affront. And they pound on those rates and pound on those rates and pound on those rates until they knock them down. And we haven't been able to figure out a way to make those tax rates sustainable. And the basic assumption that we made in the middle of the 20th century that an economy creates inequality, but we can clean that equality up with progressive taxes, that was just inadequate. We need to challenge that basic assumption, and we need to prevent the economy from generating inequality in the first place. And I think that's where progressive opinion is shifting. And some people call that pre-distribution. We need to care about pre-distribution of wealth as much as its redistribution. We need to prevent inequality from taking hold.
And part of the failure of those tax rates is that it is it's also obscure. I mean, the tax code is so complicated that it's sort of difficult for your average American, it seems to me, to be aware of just how eroded those taxes have become. And then by the time they realize this, they lack the political power because wealth inequality has gotten so out of control.
Exactly. There's a basic political asymmetry here that the rich folks can see a direct personal interest, an intense direct personal interest in reducing top rates. And average folks, average working folks, just don't have that direct personal interest in that thing. They benefit from greater equality in more indirect ways. And so with given that basic political asymmetry and giving wealth at the top, you know, they prevail. They lower those tax rates. So we need to go for an alternative.
Okay, so pre-distribution. How would we go about pre-distribution?
Well, this to me is the fun part, because there is a politically plausible path forward to going at pre-distribution. And that politically plausible path revolves around the power of the public purse. Right now, tens of billions of our tax dollars go to corporations that are expanding, that are increasing inequality by paying their top executives phenomenally more than what they pay their workers. So it's time, many of us believe, to cut off that spigot. That is to deny federal government and state government contracts to corporations that pay their executives, top executives, over 25 or 50 times what their average workers are making. It's time to end government subsidies to corporations that pay their top executives disproportionately more than their than the workers. It's time to tax those corporations that have wildly unequal internal pay systems at higher rates than corporations with more narrow pay divide. And if we go down that route, we can make a huge difference. And the great news is that we've already taken one step down that path. This year, for the first time ever in the United States, corporations must officially disclose the ratio between what they pay their CEO and what they pay their median or most typical worker. And those statistics have been coming out since March. They'll be coming out all this year. They'll be coming out every year from now on. And we can tie those ratios into legislation that leverages the power of the public purse. And that, too, has begun. This year, the city of Portland, the second largest city in the Pacific Northwest, Portland, Oregon, has a new tax on the books. And if you're a major corporation doing business in Portland, you now pay a business tax that Portland levies at a higher rate than corporations that have a narrow pay gap.
Okay, so we have, and we should say that the statistics on these ratios is a function of Dodd-Frank, which
yes.
I have to say that I'm surprised they didn't roll that back in the last assault on Dodd-Frank.
Well, corporate America fought very hard. Actually, this provision in the 2010 Dodd-Frank Act, the Dodd-Frank Act is hundreds and hundreds of pages long. This is one tiny provision in that act, and corporate America, you know, fell asleep at its lobbying switch and sort of let this slip through. Once they realized after the bill was signed that it was in there, they devoted huge amounts of resources to killing it. But the labor movement and the public interest community fought back, and we were able to preserve it, and it went into effect this year.
Okay, now we have at least some measure of this information. Presumably, it's for public companies, and the vast majority, I would imagine, of these companies are public companies that we're talking about the CEOs. So we have three essential levers here, right? Government contracts, both on the state and federal level. I know that by executive action, for instance, the Obama administration imposed not restrictions on that ratio, but would not hand out government contracts to people who had been in the past maybe involved in wage theft or or other, maybe you've got to pay a minimum wage, right? A higher minimum wage.
Yes.
So that mechanism has been used, and again, we're not legislating what the pay is. We're simply saying you're not eligible for certain government benefits or contracts if you don't comport with this. It's almost like leveraging. You don't get federal highway funds unless your drinking age is 21, which the government has done between states and the federal government. Would these contracts, this would have to be, though, statutory as opposed to executive action, right? Because Donald Trump would get in office and on day one, he would say, we're getting rid of that, right?
Yes. It has to be statutory. And that's the route that the advocacy community is going at, both at the federal level and the state level. We have five states right now that have where legislation has been introduced that goes at this. Congressman DeSaulnay from California has a bill that would tax on the federal level, has a bill that would tax corporations at a higher rate if they have a wide pay ratio. And we're now dealing with several Senate offices on writing legislation that is more omnibus, that covers all three areas that you just mentioned. And we're hopeful that at the beginning of the 2019 congressional session, we'll have an omnibus bill that will be introduced.
Do you find, let me ask you, why, and I guess these aren't mutually exclusive proposals, but why not also, impact like the stock buybacks have been implicated in that skyrocketing CEO pay because
they
own stocks. They buy them back.
Yes.
They increase the value of it. Also the capital gains tax, which I guess falls into that category of like it's just there's not enough opportunity for political will because, most people don't deal with the capital gains tax. Your average American doesn't make their money through money. And so these aren't mutually exclusive proposals. But what's your sense about how much leverage you get with this proposal politically? Like, are people more sensitive to these things because
I think so. And there's a incredibly fascinating Gallup poll that came out this past spring. 6 years ago, and then again this spring, Gallup asked the question, does the United States benefit from having a class of rich people? Very basic question. Back in 2012, the majority of Democrats said, yes, the United States does benefit from having a class of rich people. This time, in 2018, the majority of Democrats said, no, the United States does not benefit from having a class people, class of rich people. So I think that the public is beginning to see that if, when we allow wealth to concentrate it at a economic summit, we are asking for trouble as a society. And I think that gives these maximum wage type proposals that we've been talking about enormous political cachet. People do not want to see their tax dollars wasted, and they particularly don't want to see their tax dollars subsidizing rich people in our society.
I mean, I From a proposal standpoint, this is great, and I understand why it's referred to as maximum wage. But how are they when they talk about like an omnibus bill of this, right? Like where we're going to deal with all the government contracts, all the government subsidies, all the government tax breaks that we give to Corporation A. We're going to eliminate those unless Corporation A puts its worker CEO ratio, pay ratio, unless it comports with this. What do they call that? I'm not just curious because I feel like maximum wage is going to set off some alarm bells, but tax subsidies for wealth inequality is off the tongue. But.
Right. The slogan that we talk about is cap the gap. Cap the gap. Limit the divide that separates our top corporate executives from people who work at those corporations. Cap the gap, and that movement is growing internationally. So in the UK, Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party, one of its key proposals is to deny government contracts to any corporations that pay their workers, that pay their CEOs, top executives over 20 times what their workers receive.
I'm going to work on that one. I'm not sure I'm on board with cap the gap as a slogan, I got to say, Sam. But I,
okay.
What of people who say like, but if you do this, Sam, you're going to lose this class of wealthy people, and then we won't get good things like new hospitals that are named after them, or wings of a museum, or I mean, where does what of the arguments that you hear like, look, these are huge drivers of philanthropy. I mean, Bill Gates spent $700 million on a school reform program. I mean, didn't work out, but
right.
That
philanthropy is a major argument, and it has been since the initial Gilded Age. You know, if we don't let wealth concentrate at the top, we won't have philanthropic contributions, and we won't have great foundations doing wonderful things. But when you actually look at charities and philanthropy, you see a whole different side, set of dynamics. So average people in the United States actually give a higher share of their disposable income to charity than rich people. If we want to really help charities, we'd be putting more dollars in the pockets of average Americans. And then if you look at the so-called charitable contributions rich people make, the biggest single recipient of those contributions isn't enterprises that help people in need. It's the elite colleges and universities that rich people come from. So we have in Princeton, for instance, dormitories with mahogany window sills that have been built by the contributions from our super rich, and that's called charity, and they can take donations for that. We have vanity wings of art museums. At the same time, schools can't afford to hire art and music teachers. You know, it's absolutely crazy that philanthropy is not helping the United States get better. And then you mentioned Bill Gates and his education policies. We have a democracy in this country, or we hope we have a democracy in this country, and that is subverted. That is distorted when rich people can get charitable deductions for money that they throw into their pet policies and impose on the rest of us because of their wealth. So when you look closer at that, you know, that philanthropic rationale for great fortunes, it just falls apart.
Sam Pizzigotti, the book is The Case for a Maximum Wage. We will put a link to that at majorityreportradio.com. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, folks. Going to take a quick break, head into the fun half in just a moment. A reminder, this program relies on its members for its survival. You can become a member today by going to jointhemajorityreport.com And when you do, we say thank you by giving you the extra content every day. And also we say thank you to you by also saying thank you to our members. Thank you, members. Join themajorityreport.com. If you want to do a one-off donation at that same page, you'll have an opportunity to do so there as well. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Oh, my God. Look at what the cat dragged in. You walked in like, you okay?
No, no.
Well, look at Michael coming in on a Tuesday because tonight is the Michael Brooks show. He's really... Look, it doesn't. He will not be stopped, ladies and gentlemen. In front of the gray one, the silver one is the one person mark. You see that? We did that. Pretty good. Are you on, Michael? Did you cut over to Michael? Because this looks like honestly looks like you've been in the like in the wilderness. You come out like Jeremiah Jones. You walk in here.
What's that?
Wow. Google.
I feel a bit better. Thank you for asking.
All right. Yeah. Well, I was going to say, you know, it looked like you might need another half a day.
I probably will take one tomorrow. In fact, a full one. I'm going to go get my beard trimmed, calling sick.
Right. Get your manicure.
And pedicure. Pedicure is the key.
Right.
It's already pre-planned.
Well, so, Michael, assuming that you do make it to tonight's show.
I will always make it for my audience. Oh,
I got to get more stuff on my soundboard because I definitely need it. What is on the show tonight?
Derek Davidson is joining us, and we're talking about that bizarre drone attack on President Maduro in Venezuela. I don't know if you guys covered that. And sanctions kicking in on Iran. Wildcat strikes, and of course David Grisham Economic Minute, and a bunch more stuff.
All right, and Jamie, you look significantly healthier than Michael. With all due respect. What is on the Antifada this week?
Well, it actually goes really well with the interview you just did, because we talk a lot about the 70s. And Sean has a pretty detailed, wide-angle political economy explanation for sort of backing up Jefferson Cowie's assertion that from the New Deal to the Great Society was sort of it was an interregnum between two gilded ages, as Cowie said, and its conditions, the golden age of American social democracy, cannot be replicated without directly confronting the wage system. And we have Matt Crisman and Virgil Texas on to help us out with that.
That's sort of Piketty's argument, too, isn't it? That basically the Great Compression was an anomaly. And
yeah.
It's reverting to the mean.
Yeah.
Speaking of mean, what's on Literary Hangover?
Literary Hangover is we did the Maypole of Marymount by Nathaniel Hawthorne, an early short story of his, which is basically about how... some guy named Thomas Morton was using his willingness to race mix and his people's willingness to race mix as a trade advantage over the Puritans who were against that sort of thing.
Right.
Race mixing is good.
Which was not mean, which is why I led in with that segue.
I listened on Sunday evening on the train to... that episode, and it was quite fitting going through New England listening to that. And Hawthorne was a really terrible person.
He was.
I wish I should have. I know that there's a better, more sophisticated take to have, but I just couldn't help being.
You
like,
mean
what an awful
he
guy.
Was mean.
He was a bit mean. He's a very mean. Insular kind
of
guy.
I liked his description of the success of women authors explaining his lack of success. It could have been plucked from like a. I don't know,
yeah,
like some type of...
he really resented Harriet Beecher Stowe's success.
All right, whoa. Yeah. Don't let the air out of the tires, guys.
It was a good episode.
You don't want to let the air out of the tires. Don't give away the good stuff for free. All right, folks, 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920 is the number if you want to be a part of the program. I will be turning on the IMs right now. I know I didn't do it yesterday, but we'll do it today. Back in a moment.